AD 70, a new dynasty has dawned in the Roman Empire. Like the first dynasty, the one began by Rome's first emperor, Augustus, this second dynasty was also birthed through a civil war that crossed much of the length of the Roman Empire. Augustus, as you might remember from earlier episodes, became emperor on the basis of conquest and survival. When the dust settled following the Roman Republic's final civil war, Augustus was the last warlord left alive. Well, just like Augustus, Vespasian II wrestled control of the empire away from several other claimants through a violent civil war, and also like Augustus, who entered Rome with a victory over a foreign power, in his case that was Egypt, well, Vespasian also marched into Rome with a fresh foreign triumph under his belt. As we saw on the last episode, Vespasian, through his son Titus, claimed conquest over the rebellious Jews in Judea. But despite his superficial similarities to Augustus, would Vespasian succeed in founding a lasting dynasty and leave his mark, Pax Romana? Episode 25, A New Dynasty Dawns. Before we start this episode, I want to let you know that my new book, Pax Romana, The Plague That Shook the Roman World, that's Pax Romana, P-O-X, not Pax, P-A-X, that book is about to be released, and the audiobook version is starting to leak. It is read by Cassandra Campbell, phenomenal narrator. You would know her if you listened to books like Cloud Atlas or The Help. She did the biography of Abigail Adams, and it's a tremendous honor that she narrated the audiobook for Pax Romana. Well, her reading of the book's foreword, which is written by Barry Strauss, historian at Cornell University, is very good, and I'd love for you to get a chance to hear it. I'll edit it just a little for length so that you can get to the podcast. So I'm going to play that for you now before we begin the episode. Enjoy the excellent work of Cassandra Campbell. And if you haven't already, please pre-order a copy of my new book.
Princeton University Press Audio presents Pax Romana, The Plague That Shook the Roman World, by Colin Elliott. Read by Cassandra Campbell. Foreword. In this volume in the Turning Points in Ancient History series, Colin P. Elliott writes about what was arguably history's first pandemic. The Antonine Plague killed millions and was perhaps the greatest of a series of shocks in the late 2nd century that ended the Roman peace, the Pax Romana. Rome emerged from the era more brittle and less sure of itself. It went from being a kingdom of gold to one of rust and iron, as an ancient writer put it. Yet despite the importance of the pandemic, it has left only elusive evidence. It takes ingenuity and assiduousness to make sense of it. Fortunately, they are on offer. In Pax Romana, The Plague That Shook the Roman World, Elliot has written a historical detective story of the First Order. One of Elliot's chief arguments is the fragility of the empire's institutions. Roman societal and governmental structures were clumsy and often ineffective. Certainly, the legions were disciplined, but the government's grasp of economics was primitive. Its response to crisis was to issue edicts that sounded authoritative but often made things worse. The dislocations of the Antonine Plague may have contributed to the political instability that embroiled Rome in a new era of civil war after the murder of the Emperor Commodus in 192. As Elliot argues, however, perhaps the most important legacy of the disease was spiritual. It may have left in its wake a growing consciousness of catastrophe that contributed to the religious quest of the following century. That was an era in which an increasing number of Romans turned to a new religion, Christianity. Sophisticated, complex, provocative, and readable, Pax Romana tells an epic tale. Our own recent experience of pandemic makes this history even more urgent and engaging. Barry Strauss.
Wasn't that just great? I haven't heard the rest of the audiobook yet. It'll be out at the beginning of February, and you can get that audiobook through Audible or any other audiobook retailer. All right, on to today's episode. Augustus set up his regime, what would become the first dynasty of the Pax Romana, the Julio-Claudian dynasty, when he was in his early 30s. And despite the fact that Augustus would live for four more decades and grow old and sick, the images throughout his life would always show him as perpetually young. And the same was true of his descendants when they became emperor, all the way up to the Emperor Nero, the last emperor of the Julio-Claudian dynasty. But Nero's face was way too fleshy to hide, so he was a little bit of a departure from the portraiture of the other emperors in that dynasty. But Vespasian, by contrast, when he took command of the Roman Empire, he was already a grizzled old man of over 60 years. And the statues and busts that we have of Vespasian are strikingly honest, not idealized like the Augustan portraits. Vespasian's statues show the emperor's knotted neck, his pursed, serious lips, and the wrinkled face of an old man. Now, the point of this honesty was not to suggest that Vespasian was elderly and feeble, but rather that he was wise. His imperfections were a kind of proclamation. Here was a man who had accumulated a record of military victories, a hard man, a man who had endured decades of trials by combat to help build and sustain the empire that he now ruled. Well, by the time Vespasian did indeed take over, and this is again AD 70, there was no longer any doubt. The Roman Republic was gone, the Senate was effectively impotent politically, and the man who controlled the military would be the one to hold the reins of the empire. In fact, we have a bronze inscription which outlines the powers of Vespasian. It still survives in Rome to this day. You can see it in the Capitoline Museum. The decree on the inscription enumerates the sweeping powers that Vespasian claimed as his own. Powers to make treaties, control the Senate, appoint men to political offices, there are a bunch of them. But ultimately, the decree includes this all-purpose clause to, quote, do whatever things, divine, human, public, private, Vespasian deems that would serve the advantage and the overriding interests of the state. That's the Lex de Imperio Vespasiani in the Capitoline Museum. This is obviously an almost unlimited form of power. So the question is, what did Vespasian do with so much power? Unlike Augustus, he did not have to pretend to really be bound by the constitution of the republic. He could act like a king openly, even though he wasn't called a king. Unfortunately, we only have a single biography of Vespasian, and just a few short summaries of what happened during his reign. It's far less literary material than for the previous emperors that we have looked at on the podcast. So many of the details of Vespasian's reign are simply unknown to us. We do know that the civil wars of the past 18 months, the civil wars that Vespasian ended up winning, had crippled the practical functioning of the government in Rome. Vespasian had to appoint several commissioners, for example, to deal with the huge backlog of lawsuits and property disputes, and many members of Rome's elite orders, these were the senators and the equestrians, well, they were dead because of all of the purges and the counter-purges that had occurred during that long 18-month year of the four emperors. We talked about that in the past few episodes. So what Vespasian did is he appointed elites from the provinces to fill the empty ranks of both bodies, both the senators and the equestrians. Vespasian also benefited from a pretty substantial windfall of wealth. Now, some of this came directly from his conquest of Judea and the looting of Jerusalem and its temple. But Vespasian also squeezed money out of his provinces. Existing provinces were taxed, sometimes as much as double. And when that didn't produce enough money, he created a few new provinces from allied territories and cities, just basically saying, all right, you're a part of the Roman Empire now, so you need to pay your taxes. One of these provinces included the very wealthy island and city of Rhodes, a trade depot in the middle of the Greek world. Creating these new provinces gave Vespasian additional tax revenue. And then finally, to fill out whatever else he needed in the treasury, Vespasian nakedly sold political offices to the highest bidders. At least that's what his biographer Suetonius says. So Vespasian had some cash to burn. He spent some of it on that 30-day triumphal parade that we talked about in an earlier episode, celebrating the victory against the Jews in Judea. But that was only the appetizer. Vespasian started his real spending spree afterwards, getting to work on several massive construction projects. And many of his buildings were temples. That included the new temple to Jupiter Optimus Maximus that the Jews were now paying taxes to. But the one building that stands out among all of the different buildings that Vespasian built, it's a building that still dominates the modern city of Rome, is Vespasian's amphitheater. This is the building that we now call the Colosseum. This colossal amphitheater was built on grounds that were originally occupied by Nero's Golden Palace. But because of the odium of Nero, nobody liked him and nobody wanted his palace to stay standing. Well, that building was systematically destroyed, and the engineers filled in some of the palace's landscape features. And that included the massive man-made lake that was a kind of centerpiece in the Golden Palace. The colossal statue of Nero, however, was kept, and this Colossus, that was the name of the statue, it was the Colossus of Nero, well, that statue gave its name to the amphitheater that Vespasian built where that filled-in lake had been. And due to the size and the complexity of this amphitheater, this Colosseum, it would actually take around a decade to complete. Vespasian wouldn't actually live to see it finished. The amphitheater that we call the Colosseum was, in many respects, another victory monument to celebrate that final subjugation of the Jewish people in Judea. And despite the destruction of Jerusalem and its temple by Vespasian's son Titus in AD 70, there was still some work to do to pacify Judea early in the reign of Vespasian. Tens of thousands of Jews, in fact, continued to resist Roman rule in the south of Judea for several years. One of the last groups of Jews to still give the Romans fits was about 1,000 of them that were holed up in the fortifications of Masada, atop a massive plateau-like mount in the southern desert of Israel. The fortress of Masada was about 1,500 feet above the ground. It was almost impossible to reach because of the sheer cliffs on all sides of the plateau. But the Roman governor of Judea decided to besiege the fortress anyway. He used the 10th Roman Legion, which would be something like 4,000 to 5,000 men. So over several months, the legionaries plus several thousand captured Jewish prisoners who were made to fight their own people, well, they worked together to construct a massive ramp that led up this 1,500-foot cliff. You can still see it to this day. It's an incredible feat of engineering. Well, once they finished the ramp, the Romans then sent siege equipment up to the fortress, and they breached its defenses and burst onto a scene that must have forever haunted those men for the rest of their lives. What did those soldiers find within the walls of Masada? The bodies of 960 men, women, and children lay scattered, dead, throughout the complex. Most of them had died of suicide, and all the provisions and the flammable buildings of Masada had been burned. One of the final Jewish resistance groups had taken themselves out of the war against Rome. For historians, the mass suicide at Masada represents the end of the Jewish rebellion against Rome. Well, around this same time, AD 73 or so, Vespasian decided to think about the long-term legacy that he would leave. And so he awarded the title Caesar to his eldest son, Titus. This, as you might guess, was a mark of succession. Vespasian, after all, was not going to live forever. He was already in his 60s. He needed his eldest son, Titus, to carry on his legacy. And this way of passing the empire on from father to son may seem insignificant or even normal to us, but this would in fact be the very first time that such a thing had happened in Rome since the days of Rome's kings, nearly 600 years before Vespasian's day. If you'll remember from previous episodes of the podcast, all of the emperors that we have looked at had adopted their heirs. They did not pass on the empire to their own sons. This is just yet another reminder that Vespasian's regime was indeed a monarchy in all but name. Now, because of the paucity of sources, we don't know the extent of Vespasian's opposition, but the sources that we have do hint at conspiracies and plots to overthrow the elderly emperor. But none of them were successful. Why did people wish to kill Vespasian? Well, we don't know. But one thing that the sources also suggest is that Vespasian thought of himself as some kind of divine figure, maybe even a god while he was alive. This is something that both Caligula and Nero had hinted at as well. And these were emperors that were definitely not liked by members of the Senate and other elites. There are stories of Vespasian miraculously healing citizens who came to seek his help. Here's one of the stories from when Vespasian was in Alexandria, that's in Egypt, in AD 69. Quote, as Vespasian sat on the tribunal, two laborers, one blind, the other lame, approached together, begging to be healed. Apparently, the god Serapis had promised them in a dream that if Vespasian would consent to spit in the blind man's eye and touch the lame man's leg with his heel, both men would be made well. Vespasian had so little faith in his curative powers that he showed great reluctance in doing as he was asked, but his friends persuaded him to try, and in the presence of a large audience, the charm worked. That's Suetonius' biography of Vespasian. Now, anyone with familiarity with the New Testament will notice an immediate similarity to one of Jesus' famous healings. This is what is said, for example, in Mark chapter 8, verse 23, quote, and taking the blind man by the hand, Jesus led him out of the town, and spitting upon his eyes, laying his hands on him, he asked him if he saw anything. And that's Mark chapter 8. And as you might guess, Jesus healed that man through basically the same method that Vespasian used. Now, what am I trying to say by putting these two things next to each other? I'm not saying that the two accounts influenced each other. But the point here is that Vespasian's miracle, as described by Suetonius, is not just a trick or a funny story. What the story is meant to do is tell us that there was actually something divine about Vespasian while he was still alive. But Vespasian, like the emperors who claimed divinity before and after him, would prove his own mortality. In June of AD 79, the now 69-year-old emperor became ill, and as he wasted away in his villa not far outside of Rome, the emperor's final words were supposedly, I think I am indeed becoming a god. Well, even in the end, Vespasian was caught up in his own propaganda. He seemed to really think that his victories in the civil wars and his reconquest of rebellious Judea were indeed markers of divine power. And when Vespasian died, he likely expected his son Titus, who was still in his 30s, to carry on the legacy of the newly formed dynasty. But what Vespasian could not have foreseen was that Titus himself would soon suffer an untimely death, and the empire would pass on to one of the most hated emperors to ever rule the empire. A man so paranoid, murderous, and cruel that Rome would again be rocked by a violent coup. An emperor who would stifle Vespasian's dynasty before it really had a chance to get legs and walk. Well, this unfortunate emperor, as we'll see next time, was Vespasian's other son and Titus's younger brother, Domitian.
Thanks for listening to the Pax Romana podcast. For more information, including a list of primary sources and further reading, check the show notes. Music by Red Productions and Exacor. Follow Dr. Colin Elliott on X at ProfCPE or email colin@paxromanapodcast.com. Listen to more episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or just about anywhere podcasts are available. Stay tuned for the next episode of the Pax Romana podcast.